Red Eye is a program of alternative politics and culture which broadcasts live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM and around the world at cooperadio.org. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Crime and Punishment by Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky was his first masterpiece. It's a psychological analysis of a poor student, Raskolnikov, who has a theory that humanitarian ends justify evil means. This leads him to murder a St. Petersburg pawnbroker and her sister, and then to suffer pangs of guilt. Crime and Punishment, the musical, is a production by New World Theatre. It opened last night at the Roundhouse. James Fagan-Tate adapted and directed the production, and he joins me by phone this morning. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Lorraine.
Crime and Punishment doesn't seem like a natural fit for a theatrical production, let alone a musical. Why did you want to bring this long and very complex novel to the stage?
Well, I read this about 25 years ago when I was going to theater school, and I fell in love with it, and I fell in love with it in the environment of the theater school as well. So I think I was. It was a natural fit to see the drama in it. The scenes written by him in the translation that I had read back then, the scenes per chapter were so theatrical in my mind, and the images and symbols throughout the novel always impressed me and stayed with me for the last 25 years. And so I had already sketched out in the last 25 years some thoughts and approaches that I thought could help make this a stage play.
Well, it's kind of interesting to hear that you'd been thinking about it for so long. Now you've built it as a musical, but it's certainly not like an old-fashioned musical with people bursting into song all the way through. In fact, there's relatively few songs.
Well, we've never really thought of it as a musical. I knew from the beginning, because of his internal world and the way I wanted that to be achieved on stage with a group of 20 people, I knew that it was theater with music. And my friend Jalisa Pankanya, the brilliant composer of the score and the musical director, was so excited about the project when I said, let's do this as a piece of theater with music, with your music. And she loved the novel, so we got on a groove almost immediately when we started last January.
Well, it really was a stunning performance, and the musicians were on stage the whole time, and I think that was a very effective part of it. But the murder takes place very early in the book, and much of the novel's taken up with Raskolnikov's mental state following the murder. How did you deal with that, getting that on stage?
Well, I guess it was to find the scenes or the chapters or the parts of the novel that where Raskolnikov, and we did focus on him primarily as opposed to the novel does have some digressions that we had to avoid, of course, because of time, but we really focused on how he responds. So immediately following the murders, which I think happens in the play about 31 minutes into the play, we had set up this thing about the audience drawn into his why he would, or even just the landscape of his thinking about it and whether he's capable of. And then realizing once the murders happened, oh, now what do we do? Like, now what does he do for the rest of it? So it became more circumstantial. And at that point, we withdrew the obsessive music that the ensemble sings. From that moment on, the ensemble breaks away from being the collective consciousness or his internal world. That was one of the approaches that we put on it. And then all of a sudden, the play becomes less musical and balder as he faces his what he's done and he faces his delirium and his sickness. And also at that point the play was pretty dark for us, and we knew we had to sort of like keep the audience spirited up with both humor and music, so we added the song In the Heat of St. Petersburg to, you know, a waltz in contrast to the sort of moody atmospheric stuff at the top. So those are some of the devices that we used in the first act. And then Act Two, there's so much drama that's in the novel that we just follow the novel through and connected the music appropriately, the cat and mouse themes and of course the soft chew that the family do together in the dinner scene. And yeah, and we had two workshops on our way, which was between the first time we started writing this Kamiar and New World, also provided with the opportunity of working with actors in a workshop. And am I talking too much?
No, okay, carry right on.
The workshops were great because what Jalisa and I needed to do was not only hear the script read aloud, hear the music sung in its 9-part harmonies, but we needed to actually figure out some of the staging early. So the actors in the workshop, were great and indulged us with moving through a lot of the choreographic elements of the show to find out if in fact it was just a theoretical idea or if it could actually move the plot forward, having this many people standing around while he's going through his trip. And so the workshops were really helpful in going, yeah, that works. No, that's, a bit too much. Or
You're remarkably faithful to the original novel. Was it hard to get all the various subplots woven through without ending up with a 6-hour production?
Well, we did have a
The intermission was short, I do have to say. I had to knock back a glass of wine.
Well, we did have a mandate from the beginning was with the Push Festival. The Kamiar knew that we couldn't exceed 3 hours. And I had written 120 pages and stopped there. And I thought, well, I think this is probably longer than 3 hours. And our first run through was, closer to 4 than anything. But there were sections of the novel. I had 3 translations that I worked from to distill it down to a paraphrase of a sort of light contemporary paraphrase of the translations I was reading. But I had Cole's notes beside me as well. So I never got too bogged down inside one whole section of the novel because I'd go, yeah, but what's coming or where are we heading and where's the central part of Act Two? And so structurally it was easy to keep a handle on it. I had to bury things like there's many sections of Vrazumihin has a great section on his own away from Raskolnikov, and Svidrigailov, of course, who appears at the end, the landowner who dishonors Raskolnikov's sister, he has the whole last sixth of the novel, which I just couldn't include, but I couldn't exclude the character because he's critical to the whole sort of mirror that Raskolnikov faces when he sees somebody else who's a criminal. And so I had to just try to put enough of the characters there so that they had their right life, but not too much so that it bogged down the story.
Now Raskolnikov is the main figure, who actually carried out the murder, comes across as a sympathetic character in this production. He's kind of arrogant yet, but he's tormented by this act. Do you find him a sympathetic character?
I do. I thought that was so remarkable about the novel that when I first read it, I read the novel, and a lot of people go through a sort of crisis while they read the novel. They go into his mind spin, and I remember thinking how odd it was halfway through the novel, how much I cared whether he got caught, whether he turned himself in, whether he killed himself, I was always worried about him, and I kept saying, "You're worried about a murderer. This is a fascinating novel that would do that." So it's one of the features that we tried to capture, and one of the things that Kevin and I have always the fellow who plays Raskolnikov, Kevin MacDonald, a superlative actor, we always talked about how he what are the qualities that make him so appealing in the novel, and sometimes not appealing, because he has to be arrogant, he has to be mean to a lot of people suddenly, and a spoiled brat, and then how to balance it off and make sure that the audience gets into his trip. And I think that the ensemble representing his inner mind at the beginning of the show, when they're singing through his sort of rehearsing the murder and everything, I think they help the audience get close to him in a way that Dostoevsky does in the novel, that you get into his brain and therefore you are with him and you identify with him. It's all very familiar what he goes through, except none of us have plotted out a murder like he has. And then, of course, his actual confession is so fascinating in the novel because it's multi-layered. He never comes out and says, "I did it because of this one thing." It's up to the reader, and in this production, up to the audience to sort of integrate the different things that he says. But it's also that life is complicated, so there's no easy answer to why he would have done it. We can only guess, and of course, scholars have tried and tried. But I think most scholars agree that you hook into identification with the protagonist in this novel, and that's the wonderful thing, that you're hooked into you're sympathized with a murderer.
It's interesting that the process you describe as having the ensemble kind of build this intimacy towards him, because he's barely done anything before he, you know, actually starts to perform and talk. And I think you're right. There is a kind of connection with him that's already established.
Great.
Now, the novel ends with Raskolnikov's confession, and there's an epilogue in the novel where we find out what happened to him and his family, but you've just included one sentence from that epilogue. Why is that?
Well, we weren't going to have any epilogue. I had an epilogue ready where he went to Siberia.
But it went to 6 hours then?
Yeah, it went way over the limit. But then the Jalisa, who's the composer, she read the novel, and she didn't know that the epilogue was a part of the novel. So she never read the epilogue, and she kept saying, well, I love how it ends, and I was thrilled because I love the epilogue. And she said, no, those last two lines when he says, I killed her, and I said, no, there's still more. And she went back to the book, and she thought it was an afterword in the novel. She didn't realize it was a part of the novel, and she read the epilogue, and she said, oh, my God, she couldn't believe it, because Pulcheria dies in the epilogue, and you hear a little bit more about Sonia and Dunya and Vrazumikhin. And she read, and many people don't like the epilogue in the novel or object to it or say, you know, this could have been fine without it. But I always loved the epilogue because it kept opening more questions. And when I was discussing the epilogue with a variety of people, I said, well, I actually like the dream, and I like all his dreams in the novel, and I like the dream he has, because it's so horrifying that Dostoevsky keeps bringing us towards the themes of isolation and judgment and who's good and who's bad and who should be allowed to live and who shouldn't, and he exposes it. And the character of Dunya became so sympathetic and key for me in the hope of this the stage version, that I thought that Dunya could walk out and just say the one line about he had a dream while he was in Siberia, so it would infer that he was in Siberia in fact, and that he dreamt this very odd dream about the plague and how only the good ones survive, which is a bit of a shock in Dostoevsky's novel, but it's also the great thing about it is that he's not afraid of just, you know, letting his characters go through anything, good, bad, or indifferent, you know, and have an internal landscape that's quite controversial or.
Now, there's a very large cast of characters, and all of them have those long kind of multi-part Russian names. Yet I did manage last night to keep most of them straight. So I was wondering if that was something that this morning I have a cheat sheet though, and some of the names go halfway across an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. So I'm sure that was a challenge. Was that something you thought about when you were doing the writing and the adaptation?
Yeah, and I there are many more names. I think we've eliminated. Well, I just love what they bring to the novel and the play when you read it, these names. And if we can handle them without them being too encumbered, and I think the actors do a great job. We also brought a Russian coach in to teach us the accurate pronunciation of all those names. And the sound of them help in the stage production to remind us of where we are if ever we forget. And if they're done... The Russian woman, Michelle, who came in, she would just rattle them off so quickly, and we thought, well, if we can handle them really gracefully, it'll be very beautiful, and as long as the audience isn't confused.
No, it really worked well. It's great.
Oh, good.
Now you also directed the production in the heart of the city, which I also saw. That was a downtown East Side play. It was a community play last summer, and a few of the actors I recognized from that play were also in this production.
Good.
Was that as much of a switch as it sounds to go from a community play to an adaptation of Dostoevsky?
Well, at the time that I was doing In the Heart of the City, we had just opened In the Heart of the City for the Downtown East Side, and it was a thrilling experience, and I loved working with all these actors. And it was at that point that Kamiar approached me and said, would you do your adaptation of Crime and Punishment for New World? And I said yes, and he said, how many people? And I said, 21. And he said, can we do it with less? And I said, okay, 17. And he said, with less? And we got down to about 7, and I said, that's it. I don't think we can do it with less than 7. And he said, well, we'll shoot for 21. And he did it. He managed to produce it so that we could have the 21 people. And he said, who are the 21 people? And I said, well, I would like it to be a cross-cultural event where there's people from the Downtown East Side show involved because of my experience with them. It was so great, and I learned so much about theater and acting and simplicity and distillation. And then the professional theater community, great actors that I love working with that are in the show, and then students from the post-secondary theater studios like Studio 58 and SFU. We have 4 students, from 3 from Studio 58 and 1 from SFU, all of whom are just amazing. And I thought the combination of peoples in the hall could make a very beautiful St. Petersburg and a beautiful event inside the rehearsal hall where we share just a more common idea of approaching theater, that we're not all in a separated ball game, if you know what I mean. And I think everybody learned and from each other, from all sides of it, and people are still learning. They watch different people go out, and they're from the wings, and they're just amazed at how they achieve their character, and they learn, and they love working together, people who have never worked together. So that's how we brought all these people that's kind of why we brought all the people together, to be able to achieve a simplicity on stage with a combined sort of approach to acting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jimmy, I've enjoyed this morning almost as much as I enjoyed the play last night.
Oh, great.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lorraine.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
James Fagan Tate is the director of Crime and Punishment, a production of the New World Theatre Company, and it's playing at the Roundhouse Community Centre until February 6th as part of the PUSH International Performing Arts Festival. And to find out more about the many other productions in the festival, you can go to pushfestival.ca.
You've been listening to Red Eye, a program produced by an alternative media collective in Vancouver, Canada. Red Eye broadcasts live every Saturday morning from 9 until noon and can be heard around the world at cooperadio.org.